This is the second session of the interview with Bryant Curl. The date is the 22nd of January, and we're still in his office. I've been looking at some interviews that concern the development of personnel policy in the university around the early 70s, the late 60s, and I would like to ask you when you were vice chancellor, what was the state of personnel, of how faculty appointments were handled and recorded, and whether it was a matter that concerned you at that time? And this would be under Young also.
I think the answer for that is during the period from about 1970 to about 1980, the whole personnel picture was in flux for a whole lot of external reasons. Affirmative action and the institution of a UW system and a variety of more formal personnel procedures everywhere in our society made it so that the old university procedure of making personnel decisions in an offhand kind of a way couldn't survive any longer. And for example, we've always had a tradition that tenure was institution-wide. In other words, if you're a tenured professor at Wisconsin, you could not be terminated by the abolition of your department. It was the university as a whole that had responsibility for you. But nobody spelled out exactly to whom you would turn for relief if your department was indeed abolished or anything at this time. And there was an effort to try to straighten that out. There was the creation of the new academic staff category, which had been a part of the faculty category for all those years. And here we are with a system-wide decision that there will be academic staff and faculty, and the problem of dividing and determining who is what in the process of this. For example, instructor, which was not tenure track before, became tenure track, and lecturer became a sort of an anomalous outside position, where before it had been on sort of a faculty track. So all of these things, the formal announcement of positions, the institution of search and screen procedures, the formalization of faculty involvement in major administrative and other appointments, all of these things came in the decade of the 1970s, and all of them called for procedures which we've never had before. Emeritus faculty, nobody ever defined what they were, and it was viewed that an emeritus faculty member sort of continued as a member of the department if he or she felt like it and was up to it and all went well, but without any formalization of status. We didn't necessarily gain anything by this formalization because we have now defined emeritus faculty as academic staff. And this is a little contradictory and causes some problems. That's the way it is. That's what the definition is. Once you are forced to formalize, then you get some peculiar anomalies, and that's one.
When did that happen?
In the, starting about 1970, 71.
I mean, this academic, the emeritus faculty being labeled as academic staff?
They aren't labeled that, they're defined that.
Oh.
The state law, the merger law, defined faculty. It's in the statutes of the state of Wisconsin. Faculty are professors, associate professors, assistant professors, and instructors. And everyone else who is in an unclassified appointment, really by state law, is academic staff. And since Professor Emeritus is not mentioned in the statute, then Professor Emeritus becomes academic staff.
I see. So this is really a system, a state matter.
It's a byproduct of the statutes, but it has some other implications. As a matter of fact, emeritus faculty hardly ever intruded in budgetary and personnel decisions. Now legally they can't. Before, nobody knew whether they could or couldn't, but they generally didn't. But now the rules are quite explicit about it. It's this sort of...
Will you just say something into your mic, testing or whatever?
One, two, three.
Whatever you think.
Yeah. I think it should be all right now. Well, according to Serena Pondrum, this was something that all of these things were, she initiated them when she came into office, 1971. Would you say that was, I mean, you're saying it was a whole national pressure for this sort of thing?
Not national. There were national pressures, but there was additionally the merger legislation here. And yes, it is true that she was the one who was in this personnel role when these things began to descend, and had a number of them started in one way or another.
This had been, personnel matters had been under the office of the academic vice chancellor.
Personnel matters had normally been so decentralized that they were run mostly by the department, and to some extent by the deans, to a much lesser extent by the chancellor, and not by any vice chancellor.
Mm.
Personnel matters were not all that complex in an earlier period. It was the department primarily that handled personnel issues. Grievances were rare. Protests about decisions were rare. The tradition and habit governed things more than written rules, and there were therefore fewer questions of interpretation of rules, all of these things. I don't mean to be nostalgic about an earlier period. I don't think it was ideal, nor could it have lasted, but that's the way it was. And it was both the national trend, the requirements of fairness and affirmative action in regard to women and to minorities, and then in the state, the necessity to get some uniformity in procedures for all of the universities in the system, which therefore was a push toward having written procedures and policies. Now, I guess the thing I react to on who did what and when is that there were many of these things started that understandably produced problems or didn't work or were ambiguous or were contradictory, and a great deal of time was spent straightening these out. But I expect it would have been spent.
When you came into office,
yes,
you mean?
That was a major effort. But I think that would have been spent in any case. I think it was an evolutionary process where you're inventing something new. There are going to be all kinds of problems.
Can you give some examples?
Oh, sure. We have a sizable number of practicing physicians at the UW hospitals who do not do research. In the old days, they were faculty. Now, if they're faculty, they go through the divisional committees where the research criterion is very heavily used. So a decision was made to create a new category called Professor Perrin CHS, Center for Health Sciences. This is an academic staff position. It does not carry executive committee membership. People in it do not go through divisional committees outside their college. Their promotions and so on are all handled within the college. And some of our senior and better people in the clinical sense are on this kind of appointment. And what are their faculty rights? What do you do, for example, when you have a department that is primarily made up of clinicians? Who provides the governance in what ways in that department? Was it a good idea to detach this group? Should we have found some way to build them into faculty and modify our tenure criteria rather than our definition of who who is a professor. But, this is the kind of thing where confusion arose.
Whose idea was this?
I'm not sure who designed it.
Or how did it come up?
It came up because the problem was so evident. Here you got your divisional committees announced that this is a research university and that the criteria will be fundamentally capacity to do research and research performance. Then you have a practical training program like a medical school, which operates a hospital, and you can't treat 500 patients, 500 bed patients and outpatients, except with clinicians. So you have these clinicians, they're an important part of the hospital operation and of the student training program, but they are large numbers of them, not at all research people. They're only practitioners and teachers.
Well, I mean, did faculty and their department say, look, these guys aren't doing any research, or was it the chancellor of the Center for Health Sciences?
A combination of two things. One, it was the divisional committees, which are cross-disciplinary, as you know. The other, it was the med school itself saying that, and again, this is quite common now in med schools all over the country, the problem. The solutions are not common, but the problem, these people are different. These are two different types. And yes, in a research university, you do want your decisions, your basic decisions, in the hands of people who believe that research is a good thing, who understand what it is, who are at the forefront of it. So the med school, I would think, posed the problem by saying, we value both kind of people, we consider them important, we want the leadership role in the design of the School of Medicine to be in the hands of research-oriented people, but we don't want the other people to feel that this means that we discount what they contribute. So this was why this two-track professor and professor-not-professor was created.
It's funny, it didn't come up earlier, I should think.
Didn't come up earlier because we simply, they were all defined as faculty. We had no academic staff.
Somebody didn't say 10
years
earlier.
There were only two categories of classified employees and unclassified. And you were either, these were members of the faculty, full members.
Oh, I see.
And by the way, it had some impact on our institution because with such heavy clinician representation in the faculty of the school, I would say it probably delayed us in getting moving in research programs in medicine here. We didn't have a research tradition 20 years ago uh-huh. in the med school, and we do have a very important one now.
Yeah. It's interesting that it makes me think of something Henry Lardy said. Although he, I guess, still doesn't feel that there's a very strong research tradition in the med school yet.
Well, there isn't a research tradition across the med school.
Mm.
But, for example, the surgery department is preoccupied with surgery. But they do have some people there who are doing excellent research. And in the whole area of treatment of cancer, for example, there's first-rate research going on. There's some other areas where we are at the forefront on research, but there's hardly any medical school that applied research can be done in the medical school setting, but it's very hard for a clinician to do basic research.
Mm-hmm.
It's a contradiction in terms and in definition of job.
So can you give another example? Something from...
Of ambiguous rules? Sure, we're in the middle of a question about one right now. The Academic Staff Committee, Review Committee, has come in with the recommendation that any terminations of academic staff be appealable to a peer group, which means to a group that includes other academic staff.
Mm.
But without getting into the merits or the fairness of this, faculty dismissals or terminations or the appeals route there is through the faculty. But the argument is not that it takes faculty to judge faculty, but that the ultimate governance structure for the institution is the faculty in coordination with the chancellor and regents. Nobody has said that the academic staff plays this governance role, and so the academic staff review body has not been a peer review. Okay, here's a contradiction. What is the fair and proper thing to do? It isn't settled to this day. Uh-huh. It's still being discussed. Similarly, the whole role of academic staff in institutional governance, we have a faculty senate. That senate doesn't govern the faculty, it governs the institution. There are pressures for an academic staff senate. What would it govern? What would its role be? But in the absence of it, the argument is, how is the academic staff represented? These are some of the kinds of, not contradictions so much as unanswered questions that resolve themselves over time by a kind of case law.
Sounds, being a member of the academic staff, I ought to be in favor of, but it sounds to me a bit like the TAA wanting to have control of educational planning. Mm.
Well, I think many academic staff have a very proper concern about job security, about fairness and treatment on hiring, firing, promotions, and so on, and about being represented in areas of decision making where they have something to offer. But when you talk about an institution-wide senate, the third one of these is least well represented. Academic staff have a very considerable voice at the departmental level in many departments, I'd say in most departments, on things like planning use of resources, planning program, even discussing what kind of staffing needs or directions of growth, all of these things varying by department and program. The academic staff do have a voice, and this is a thing you would fight to protect. Conversely, you're not going to fight to protect a two-house parliament, an academic staff senate, and a faculty senate to decide on whether we should have a school of veterinary medicine. That's a much less appropriate kind of a question.
Is that what they have in mind?
No. I think most academic staff have in mind a concerns of the kinds I just mentioned. Mm. But it does look peculiar that you have a faculty senate and you have no comparable body for academic staff. It violates some people's view of symmetry.
In 68-69, were any of these matters presenting themselves to you as demanding attention? Any kinds of personnel matters?
There were no categorical personnel matters that were demanding attention. No.
Well, I ask that because with the TAA demands as to how they wanted to be treated, and wanting to have things spelled out, were faculty and academic staff saying there should be more clarity as to benefits and
I'm sure there were some who were saying that, but in 1968-69 and even now, a great deal of the control. The spelling things out suggests that here is the employer and here's the employee. Uh-huh. Well, the things that really matter in a department, most of them, are the employer is the employee. And before the academic staff-faculty separation, this was even more so.
Yeah.
You had a group that, although there were issues of status at the different levels of appointment, nevertheless, they were the faculty of the department. Everybody who wasn't classified was the faculty of that department. And Therefore, the control of the programmatic issues, there it was. There wasn't, the employer was the employee. And the grievance issues and the salary issues and the promotional and pay issues, I guess, never have bulked large in absolute numbers, and they didn't bulk very large then. And the whole, if the whole of our structure of governance rested on the need to have salary and promotional issues spelled out, we wouldn't have a faculty senate, and I suppose what we would have is a union contract and union and administration bargaining, if all there were the bread and butter issues. But the issues that matter in a department or in the institution to the program are mixed issues where the administration often has less control than the department and the faculty.
Yeah, I guess it would come, the push would have come from the affirmative action people, the women, presumably, in the late 68, 69. I think they were already
sure, but
active.
Even there, your question is...
And what they would want was proof that, or evidence about women's appointments and women's salaries. And that, I guess that's what stirred or led to the final creation of Serena Pondrum's job.
I didn't really realize that, but no, even on the issue of women's appointments, your concern there would be whether you have failed to make the right choice, or whether you have discriminated in your choice on the basis of gender, or discriminated in your later personnel decisions. And I guess I could say very frankly that I think this institution is quite clean on the whole area of, did we choose the best person, and having chosen that person, did we advance her or him equally well along? What no university was clean on at that time, and we are much better off now, is the public announcement of open positions. It was too easy then for a group not to think about possible candidates who were out of there. If the hiring was done on very much a personal basis, who would be a good British historian? Well, let's see, we know all the British historians, let's call them. It's too easy in that kind of a setting to overlook good people who happen to be women or happen to be black or Chinese or whatever. And that now is much better taken care of by the announcement procedure. But this wasn't the creation. I don't think an office was created for this purpose. This was...
Well, apparently it was for developing records so that there would be evidence that of what had been done. But this, you weren't getting this in 69, let's say. You weren't getting complaints that women weren't being considered for positions properly.
No, you did have. Well, no. No, there were, and still are, virtually no complaints of this kind. By virtually no, I mean an employee group of well above 10,000, maybe a dozen or so complaints a year about discrimination in making a personnel decision. And often these are not complaints really based on the discrimination by gender or ethnic group, but based on the fact that this is a good way to file a complaint. So I don't think discrimination at the hiring level has ever been an enormous issue here, except, as I pointed out, in the business of how you let people know about the availability of a position. Much more important is the building of the potential faculty pool and providing resources, providing resources for young women faculty or minority faculty to advance themselves academically.
Yeah.
Making sure that once on the job, they can get ahead in it. Now, what I was going to say, and this I'm sure is what was referred to, is that federal legislation provides that institutions that have federal contracts must be in compliance with federal affirmative action legislation. Mm-hmm. And this means that they must have an affirmative action plan. That plan has to be, or becomes a very complicated kind of thing, because you have to look in terms, do you want to cut that? And,
yes.
All right, your federal plan is very complicated because you can't expect to hire in a field where people are not available. So your federal plan has to have the availability figures by field, how many people are available in the pool from which you hire in the field that you're talking about, and then your own record on hiring. Yeah. And it also has to have goals on, given this kind of availability pool, what percentage of your next hires will be in the affected groups. And that's a difficult statistical and record-keeping problem because it means you got to keep detailed records of current staff, of applicants, and of hires by department for the whole institution.
And this whole great push toward record-keeping, which is really what this was about, or a lot of it. Yes, and the enforcement of, of the, is what was going on, I guess.
No, virtually none of that record-keeping capacity was in place when I came into this, the Vice Chancellor's office.
Well, that's a very startling statement.
No. Well, as we tried to get our hands...
Staggering, in fact.
Why?
Well, because of what Serena Pondra said about what her job was and what she was doing in the period, which was to develop these records at great effort and
mm-hmm. Well, I suppose I ought to word this a little differently. When she came into her job, nothing was in place. She was starting from ground zero. And she then set out to try to develop these figures for departments, both the availability pool, the hiring, present composition, mm-hmm. the hiring record. But there was nothing computerized, mm-hmm. so that there was nothing you could pull up in the way of totals immediately. There were, understandably, necessarily, all kinds of duplications, and in this crazy kind of university, does a joint appointment count half in each department?
Yes, that's one of the things she talks about, the 10-year home issue.
And so it was complex, complicated, and the review that occurred the first month that I was around was the one in which we were decreed to have an inadequate record capacity and inadequate records. And
from
we devoted...
From your point of view or from the system's point of view?
No,
or?
From the point of view of the federal audit as to compliance. The federal audit found us out of compliance by virtue of not having an adequate record and record keeping capacity.
Was this UW-Madison?
UW-Madison, yeah.
There was some talk about Madison not being able to get records from the system, I mean the administrative data processing.
No, nothing about it. We keep our own data records on that, and I can't imagine what that would be.
You mean shouldn't have needed things from the system?
Shouldn't have needed things from the system, and we've been very careful to keep our affirmative action records separate from those of the system because this is an institution that ought to be judged by itself, and so should the others.
You know, this is where my, with doing this kind of interviewing, I know a little bit about a great many facts. It now occurs to me that I think what the complaint was that the system couldn't get Madison's records. That way around. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I did say that we have been very chary about having the system viewed as an institution.
This was before your time.
Well, then...
Maybe it's still going on.
Yeah, then and since.
I see.
There's... outside agencies would love to view the UW system as a single institution.
Mm-hmm.
This would be easier for them to deal with.
Yeah.
We have fought hard against this, and I guess this fight was underway before I came in, and it was underway while I came in, while I was in.
So it's a legitimate
fight. And it'll be
fight.
Going on in the future yeah. for two reasons. One is we are not a single institution. We're a federation of a bunch of institutions, and it would be a tremendous mistake to have any of us vulnerable for the acts of the others. Suppose, for example, that either of two things happened. Either the university at Superior, with a faculty of a couple of hundred and with a couple of thousand students, was barred from any kind of federal granting because of a report that the UW-Madison was not in compliance with affirmative action. Or conversely, if the UW-Madison, with 10,000 or so employees and 44,000 students, were barred from federal contracting because Superior was out of compliance. It simply is wrong to view these as one institution, and it's very dangerous, and they're not. And there have always been, often not really well thought out pressures from both federal and state government to try to deal with only one, because that's so much easier.
One of the things she mentions is getting departments to send copies of appointment and promotion letters, and that none of this had been systematized.
Well, it's true, it hadn't been systematized, and it hasn't been systematized to this day. The further we got in that, the more clear it was that it's one more piece of red tape, because the amount of time it would take to really look well through an appointment or a promotional letter at the UW-Madison administrative level is simply too great. There are, if you include academic staff, there are probably 1,500 such letters a year. And if you allot an hour and a third to each letter to see whether it properly covers the subject, you got one person a year reading the letters. And I think we fairly soon concluded that this piles up an accumulation of paper that we can't use and don't need.
So some of these were coming in?
No, they were coming in, yeah. Some. But generally speaking, this place continues to operate on the basis that the details of personnel function are best carried out at the dean's office, because the dean is closest to where the work mm-hmm. is going on. And that you get your responsibility by putting the finger on the dean to be responsible for these things. Assume that, or expect that, the dean will carry out that role and will review appointment letters. And this is done very religiously and carefully by our deans now. Deans are much more sensitive to this now than they once were, because they have found so many situations in which one minor mistake in wording has made them vulnerable or liable. So now there's a lot more attention to the precision of appointment letters. But we were finding that it was much better to get this through the deans than to try to rely on some omniscient person who could read all the letters and make sure they were all in order.
Well, that was definitely the intent then, was that they would all come here through mm-hmm. the deans.
Well, that's one more of the things that you learn over time. At the time, may well have seemed to be a good idea, and it's only as you look at it in operation that you realize the difficulties of it and understand that you got to try another route.
I guess what she was thinking of was the enforcement of not entirely. She says it wasn't just affirmative action, it was generally fairness sure. and salaries and that sort of thing.
No, on questions of fairness and salary, I don't think there's any route that will work on that, except depending on a complaint to stir review, because you can't look at the figures on a page and decide what this name and this dollar figure and this name and this dollar figure means in terms of academic preparation, performance, quality of work, responsibility, departmental role. There's no way anybody outside can make those judgments except as complaints or some systematic statistical reviews lead you to find problem areas.
Except I can see a militant feminist group saying, well, that's all very well to say, but that just makes it possible for you people not to give the women as high salaries as the men. I mean, weren't they saying that? Wasn't that the whole the burden of the
Well,
effort?
I don't mean to be argumentative on this, but in what sense would reading the appointment letters give you a clue as to what was happening in that area?
Well, I don't no, I agree with you. I'm just, it sounds to me, I imagine that it's at that point that they would look at salaries and see always 10% below and say it can't always.
Well, sure, you can look at, salaries and, but the appointment letters, I don't, the salaries are all published annually in the Red Book and can be analyzed. And there are two kinds of monitoring that have gone on all the time that I've been involved in administration and before, I mean, probably all the time since at least 1970. One is the monitoring of entry-level salaries. And these are reviewed in the Vice Chancellor's office to make sure that there are no inequities in the entry-level salary for any reason. You see a salary that is lower than the others, you say why. Mm-hmm. And if the reason isn't a pretty good one, then you quarrel with the dean and the department about it. And the second thing is the allocation of merit raises each year. We've gotten a percentage from the state government. And this is always monitored separately to make sure that the percentage salary increase for women is exactly the same as for men as a group. Mm. And that the percentage increase for academic staff is exactly the same as for faculty. So that you haven't, these kinds of monitoring make it so that it has been impossible, even if anyone had wanted to divert salary money from men to women or from women to men.
So you check all of these figures?
It's done by computer, but
oh,
yes,
I suppose so.
Every year there's...
Since 1970. Hmm? But you said since 1970. Mm-hmm. You weren't here.
Well, I said since about 1970, which would have been the first, I don't know when this actually started. Mm. When I returned here in 1974, this was in place. Mm. And statistically, we were analyzing the salary percentages.
I see, okay. Yeah.
And so, and it's gone on.
I thought maybe you were... I knew you weren't around the back room, but I...
No, I didn't. This is not something I instituted. This is something that was instituted. Yeah.
Well, so when you came into office, you said one of the first things you did was to review what was happening with personnel records. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
What else did you, what was your personnel policy? What did you institute at that time?
Oh, we made a substantial, first we appointed an associate vice chancellor for personnel and said this person, Mary Ann Yodella Smith, will be responsible both for academic and for classified personnel.
We'll had she those, been here before?
She's in the School of Journalism as a professor.
Oh.
We said, we'll be responsible for all kinds of personnel decisions. So, actually, Classified had operated pretty much independently, and the leadership in Classified personnel policies had pretty much been taken in the UW system. And this produced some places where interests of
classified personnel and of unclassified weren't reconciled too well, and in any event, we decided that we ought to have the whole personnel thing not just nominally under one head, but actively under one head. And we said we wanted Mary Ann to take charge of that classified personnel office and try to make it more responsive to schools, colleges, and departments. And at the same time, to deal with all the fringe benefits questions and others. Fringe benefits are always a problem because they're set by state government. They often don't fit the academic setting. And we put this into the package. Fringe benefits, affirmative action records, the whole affirmative action office and program, classified personnel and unclassified personnel. And, well, that was first.
And, well, anything else? Was there any other major change that you made? Or?
You don't make major changes in a university like this.
Little changes.
Yeah. No, they're... organizational and structural changes don't make all that much difference. And... no.
Well, all right, what happened to the secretary of the faculty's office? I mean, that was functioning in the late... Well, it went on functioning.
Well, it's been functioning. Yeah.
What was at stake when you were here in the late 60s?
The things that have happened in the Secretary of the Faculty area since the late 60s, one, we have a Faculty Senate now, and the agenda and minutes of Faculty Senate are a much more active thing than the old agenda and minutes of faculty meetings. Now, that started when 1970, I guess, the Faculty Senate came in. Two, we have the divisional committees, and the divisional committee's role has become much more elaborate because now, where before divisional committees made their decisions on the basis of fairly limited documentation, now, both because they want to be more sure, the institution's bigger and it's harder to make judgments about diverse fields. They want to be more sure that they're right, and also because they want to be able to defend what they're doing, they demand much bigger packages, much more elaborate documentation for divisional committee decisions. Thirdly, the university committee has taken a much more active role in many more things. There are many more issues that come before the university committee. They're part of the growth of the institution, part of the growth of the external bureaucracy, part of the changes in the times, but the university committee's role has expanded enormously. Okay, the secretary of the faculty 15 years ago was really a fairly leisurely kind of a job where you didn't have to manage a sizable staff and you didn't have to service some very active committees, divisional committees and university committee. You had to service them, but they were less active and it was less of a role. And I'd say that over the years, the role of secretary of the faculty, both in relation to university committee, in relation to divisional committees, and in relation to faculty senate, has gotten much, much bigger. And this means much more of a managerial job, and that's the change that's occurred.
So you said the role of the secretary of the faculty had gotten bigger.
Mm-hmm.
For a time, though, it got smaller to the point of nearly disappearing.
Well, how did it get smaller? What things?
Well, the way Charles Loomer talks about it, that as of about, I think it was 1976, the university committee had taken over a great deal that they used to do and was not, I'm not being precise about this, but the information is there, was not paying attention, in fact, to the secretary of the faculty. and that the work they used to do in connection with records had been taken over by the personnel office, so that there was nothing left, and he went to Ed Young and said, in fact, there's nothing for me to do, I'm going to resign. And he felt quite bitter about the fact that both that Ed Young didn't, well, he said Ed Young probably sort of didn't acknowledge it, which in a way I suppose was nice of him, but that the university committee never said anything to him about the fact that he was resigning. And it, apparently it was all just left in a kind of a haze.
Well, let's see, the personnel records that he's talking about, dating back to the time when the secretary of the faculty was really the secretary of the faculty, the tradition was established that there was a card kept for each faculty member, had a form number, but I've forgotten what it is, that gave the name and the basic education and so on, a minimum biographical card. Mm-hmm. And I expect it must have gone back 70 or 80 years that the secretary of the faculty kept these.
Yeah.
It very quickly became apparent that this is inappropriate. This isn't, the data don't come in to the secretary of the faculty, they come in through the personnel route. And so, yeah, it is true, those were taken over by the personnel office, which is where I think they belong. I don't think there's any argument about that.
It's obvious that it had to happen. But
the other thing is that the divisional committees were, I think at the time that Bill Loomer is talking about, nobody really recognized what a demanding job it was going to be, keeping personnel records in order for the large number of transactions of the divisional committees and simply servicing those committees. And similarly, the university committee, if Bill feels that they were taking functions that might have been secretary of the faculty, I suppose they were really doing their own secretarial work, again, because nobody realized what a tremendous chore it was becoming. And at the time that he's talking about, I think, or shortly after that, the awareness came that these jobs together have grown very significantly.
He said that at one point, I guess it was Steve Chafee, went to the Senate and said, if you have any, to the faculty, if you have any, I'm not sure they used the word problems, but come and talk to the university committee. And Loomer said normally they would have come to the secretary of the faculty. So the whole picture he creates is a sort of a dwindling down. And he speaks of having a staff of five people who were, in effect, had nothing to do, although they were still employed, because of the loss of...
Well, for one reason or another, it's obvious that what he's saying and what you're saying is that the university committee and these divisional committees were not being served through the structure that they are now. Mm. And so that's the change that has occurred. Now, it's one alternative would have been for the university committee to develop its own staff and for the divisional committees to develop their own staffs, in which case the role of secretary of faculty would have diminished even further. Mm. And his appraisal would have been correct. And this is a decision that Irv Shane made, and the rest of us joined in, that that secretary of the faculty position is going to service these faculty committees. Yeah. And now does. So I suppose one more of the things in an institution that's changing rapidly, nobody had clearly defined what the workload was going to be. Nobody had clearly spelled out how it was to be handled. And I think it's now working reasonably well, and it is defined now. Mm. But because it had changed and react to changes more or less slowly, it hadn't been defined.
Yeah, well,
and I suppose I can understand.
That's what I see the picture as.
I can understand his perception that things were slipping away from him, but
I I suppose there are quite a number of different offices where somebody is in charge who, in fact, is not up with what things have to be, and everybody has to flow around until a new person comes in.
Well, it isn't so much a particular person who isn't up to the changes. It's that an institution changes quietly and without people perceiving the change, and whenever there's a major administrative shakeup or a new group comes in, then this is the time when someone can say, now let's back off and look at all these pieces and see how they fit together. Yeah.
1970s was a very, there was a great deal of change was going on, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, it would have had to do with merger and with relations to the legislature. Could you characterize?
Well, it's a period when I was not here. 1973, I think, would be your peak of that period of change, when you had the merger come through and had to define all the relationships that merger created. But there was less. Well, that was the big source of change in about 1973. Merger made a very significant difference at this university.
Would you want to say what, I mean, it obviously did, but would you want to say what you have in mind specifically by that?
Sure, two or three things. One is, and this was a good thing and intended, it moved many of the arguments about higher education out of the Capitol and relieved both the legislature and the faculty and administration of making arguments in the legislature as to the relationships among different institutions. And probably this current salary fracas is the first real example of the kind of thing that inevitably goes on when institutions have their battles at the legislative level. So that's one thing it did. Another thing it did, though, is produce, and I think I said this before, tremendous pressure for uniformity, for rules that can apply equally to all universities in the system. What's fair for one ought to be fair for the other. Whereas, in fact, the situations are quite different, and uniformity doesn't create fairness, and fairness doesn't create uniformity. You've got to have a diverse set of rules to govern the diversity in the system. This is understood by system administration and by many of the regents, and there's some effort to accommodate it, but still the pressures are always to have a uniform set of procedures. So that's another problem.
So the chancellor's office has to fight that all the time.
Yeah. And another problem is that when you're allocating budget in a large system, it's like the statistical problem of where you round something off. You round off by taking away from the largest number in the series. And so an easy way to pick up a few thousand dollars for this or a few thousand for something else is to take a smaller percentage, much smaller, from Madison, but a much larger dollar amount. And I think there has been some effect of damage to the UW-Madison's budget by the fact that you have a whole system in which there are very small institutions, you hit a budget crisis, and they can't, a small amount to us would be a terribly big amount to them. So sacrifices are not equally shared. I can give an example on this. In UW Extension several years ago, when they fell upon hard times, they had to reduce their positions and had to reduce their programs. And those reductions fell most heavily on the Madison-based extension people, because the Madison-based extension activity was by far the largest. Mm-hmm. So the one or two people at this small center and the one or two at this and the one or two at this were protected, and we'll take three or four off the Madison-based. This kind of thing happens, and it's just inevitable in a consolidated structure. So that's another problem. I'd say a fourth problem is that there is a kind of a subtle but serious whittling away of identity of the UW-Madison. I hear repeatedly the term the Madison campus. Well, I don't hear the term the Berkeley campus or the Los Angeles campus or the Santa Barbara campus. They've managed to establish there that the University of California, Berkeley is the University of California, Berkeley. But here, I think there is a really serious question whether the combined erosion of funds and of salary levels and of stature is going to... I think there are threats to the future of this university, and I think they come by this, or some of them come by this force of being merged into an unlike system.
Is it conceivable that the language could have led to this? I mean, what if we just had called it, as one does Berkeley, one speaks of Berkeley? You couldn't call this Madison, would you?
It's the University of California, Berkeley. It's the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA.
But when you refer
the
to
language
it
is the same.
You say Berkeley.
Yep.
But you don't and don't want to say Madison. I mean, one doesn't want to say Madison.
Because for so many years, this was Wisconsin.
Yes.
And externally, it always will be when at Harvard or at Minnesota, in the universities there, they're not going to talk about Madison, they're going to talk about Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And when they talk about Wisconsin, they're going to mean this university.
Yes.
Not Whitewater, not Stevens Point, but this university.
Well, it's a... And how do you, in the chancellor's office, police these little slices off the top of the budget? Is that, you must have to have somebody watching that all the time?
I think fairness would require a person to say that the UW system administration generally has been aware of this problem and has worried about the quality of Madison and has tried to protect Madison, but still, when they have to make their hard choices, cutting 10% out of the budget of a small university or 0.1% out of Madison's, the latter is easier.
But I mean, how do you find out that that 0.1% is being cut off?
You find out after the fact.
But somebody must fight then.
Sure. That's a...
Is that the budget officer or is
it? No. There is and always will be a constant quiet battle between the chancellor and UW system administration to make sure that we don't get mistreated. That's the job. That's the territory.
Was that part of your job?
No, generally the chancellor is the one who would represent the institution on this. The others in the chancellor's staff would be the ones alert to places where we're likely to get hurt, but it would be the chancellor who would defend the university, because you're talking about negotiations by a head of this institution with the head of the federated body.
Yeah. This is tape 4 of the interview with Bri Curl. Let's turn to the TAA then.
All right. The thing that I'd want to say about that is that in a way, it's always been a mystery to me why the TAA has generated so much conflict rather than labor peace. I look at the National Labor Relations Act and the other acts that promote collective bargaining, and these always carry a preamble that the purpose of these is to promote harmonious and peaceful labor relations. And it's been something of a mystery to me as to why the TAA has been, the relationship with them has been one that has generated what, two or three strikes, one work stoppage, half a dozen strike votes in a period of less than a dozen years. One hypothesis might be that you're dealing with a very oppressive and very difficult employer. This I don't believe. And so the explanation that makes the most sense, as I look at the history of the TAA, has been that you have an organization, first of all, it's transient. Its leadership at one point is not the same as at an earlier point, and so it the kinds of quiet commitments that are made between labor and management in an ordinary situation don't get made here because you've got a whole new cast of characters coming on. This has been a problem over and over. The most recent case I can think is the issue in the last contract that we had of whether the issue of criteria for appointment. The TAA had argued they would have liked to be able to dictate that the criteria for that they have a voice in the criteria for appointment. As you know, when you appoint a teaching assistant, you got two things in mind. One is quality as a teacher, and the other is role as a graduate student. And you wouldn't want to appoint as a TAA a bad graduate student, even though that person's a great teacher. Nor would you want to appoint a bad teacher, even though that person is a great graduate student. And the idea that an arbitrator or a collective bargaining group should have a hand in deciding who are the good graduate students properly appalled many faculty members. So every time TAA brought up the idea of criteria, the bargaining team tossed it out. And finally, they agreed on a clause which you could go back to the contract and verify, but roughly what it says is that every department will post the criteria it uses, but that nothing except the posting of the criteria will be grievable or okay. 90 days later, TAA files a grievance that the chemistry department is not following the posted criteria. Now, regardless of the merits of that, this is a clear-cut violation of the contract when you say nothing else is grievable. But now let's take this to arbitration. And you say, but look, you sat down here 90 days ago and you agreed to this language. Oh no, we didn't sit down here 90 days ago. We weren't here. The people who made the agreement, large number of them are no longer around. And so I think the best story of this kind I know, it wasn't the TAA, but one of our other student unions. We're bargaining with them, and the union leadership demands the removal of a particular clause. And our bargainer says, look, that clause is in there because you demanded 3 years ago that it be there. Oh. So there's a recess, and one of their leaders gets our bargainer aside and says, look, would you mind telling me, just as a friend, why did we want it in 3 years ago? This kind of thing happens on this sort of union leadership. The other thing is, I think there's no question that a large wing of TAA wanted to use the negotiations to progressively get more and more involved in the academic planning, the academic process, and toward the end began to use the arbitration route to do this. Realized that you take the contract, you file a grievance on it, you go to arbitration, and since you get part of what you grieve for, the contract becomes broadened by the arbitration route, and the arbitrator will have no sensitivity as to which things are academic and which are not. And it was this that finally caused the rupture with the faculty. But it wouldn't have caused a rupture, I think, if there hadn't been this desire to broaden the contract to get into the academic planning.
You're speaking about that. This is before 1970.
No, no, I'm talking now about 1979-80.
Oh.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about progressive efforts.
I have a follow that didn't follow the 1980 thing terribly closely, except to see that it all was nipped in the bud.
the TAA filed a charge of an unfair labor practice against the administration for involving the faculty in the bargaining. They said the issue here is between administration and TAA. The faculty has no place in bargaining about TAA responsibilities or contracts. Well, it's that sort of thing that that the faculty finally exploded about, and quite predictably, I think, and will again.
Did Ed Jung consult with you as to whether to recognize the TAA?
He consulted quite generally. I think the decision in the end was his, and I'd say solely his. And I have something that's purely speculation, but I'd like to put it on the record, and that is that I think Ed was misled in a way by having been so close to people like Jake Friedrich and Bert McNamara, who were first-rate statesmen in labor relations. And I think Ed believed that in an academic setting, with people of goodwill on the university side and people of goodwill on the union side and people who were going to go on to be like McNamara and like Friedrich, what you would have is really a model of harmonious relationships that you could build here, if ever anywhere in the world. People who understood one another and worked together as a team, and true harmony. And that's my guess as to what was finally the deciding factor in his choice to recognize. I think there are others who would have been more skeptical about it because they, Bert McNamara and Jake Friedrich are most magnificent models. They were great leaders of labor. They were great statesmen in their field. They were, by the way, both great members of our Board of Regents. And with people like either of them in TAA leadership, I think it might have been quite different.
You yourself would not have recognized them, if you'd had to say?
It's a little hard to go back and try to guess. There's another factor, of course, and that is how much problem might have arisen through a strike for recognition. And I guess I can't say what I would have done if it had been solely my decision. My guess is I would not have recognized him. But there were pluses and minuses on that, and I don't think it was a wrong decision to try to find out whether this noble vision would work. It might have, and noble visions are worth trying for. But I think it's clear it didn't.
You knew about the Mulvihill report, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, and at one point you attended a university committee meeting, and there was an agreement that the TAs would meet with the chancellor regularly, on a regular basis, mm-hmm. and the university committee, or maybe a representative, to discuss things. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So you were already concerned, is that right?
Oh, sure. Sure. I would like to say two things about that. One is, I think the treatment of teaching assistants here was in general very good indeed. Having been one myself only a few years before, I know that, depending on departments, but you were paid well, you had interesting work that contributed to your career, and in general, this was not a bad employer to work for. Nevertheless, there were, and the Mulvihill report brings it out, there were problems with some departments and some situations. I think probably the worst one, the one I find least defensible, is a department that would bring a student here as a TA for a year and then dump that student and go on to bring another student here. Even if the student was told in advance, this is only a one-year appointment, and at the end of it there'll be nothing, Still, considering the problem of non-resident tuition, that was a cold thing to do. That's the second issue. The waiver of non-resident tuition for TAs forced departments who wanted to support as many students as possible to make the TA stipend and workload as small as possible. So if we can have six TAs each at 1/6 time, then we've given six good graduate students some help and the non-res remission. And if we have two grad students half-time, then we haven't done as much either for the department or the program or the students. Nevertheless, it was, I think, a mistake to go down to these small proportions of grad student support. Although you must remember that at that time, many graduate students had no support at all, and that students did expect, grad students did expect, to pay a large share of their own way. Nevertheless, the Mulva Hill Committee and Common Sense at the time argued for larger stipends, even though you supported fewer students.
Did you go to these departments and say, look, you shouldn't be doing this?
At the time, much of the thing that I'm talking about had been corrected at that time. For example, the grad school instituted a minimum one-third appointment, and where before it had been one-sixth. Mm-hmm. One-third, while, and I think that's still the, yeah, it is still the rule, and is now in state statute again, the one-third time. All right, this was a much more reasonable thing, mm-hmm. and spreading these out to 1/6 time, one of the things that, as I recall it, the Mulva Hill Committee said ought to be changed, and it was changed by grad school administrative ruling imposed on the departments then and there. The issue of dumping a student after a year was discussed with departments, and I think again with the Dean of LNS taking quite a bit of leadership in it. Again, departments made very dramatic changes in that. So there was progress being made. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, without saying this as a criticism of TAA, I think the progress made at that point was greater than has been made since. But sure, there were abuses. They were not widespread, they were departmental, but they were significant. I remember a graduate student coming in tears because here she was, finishing 1 year of straight-A work in one of our departments, and yes, I did call this department, and she had just received notice that she wouldn't be renewed. She's 1 year along on her PhD, and do I blame her for being indignant and grieved? No, I don't.
You couldn't do anything about it.
Well, as a matter of fact, the department did reconsider. But you shouldn't have to, this kind of an abuse, and it was one, shouldn't have occurred. From the department's point of view, it says, first we warned her, we told her in her first letter of appointment mm-hmm. that this is only 1 year. And secondly, it's our goal to support partly in some way as many good students as we can, not to give a free ride for a few. So the department from its perspective was behaving reasonably, but an outside perspective wouldn't agree with that, I don't think.
Well, you must have felt rather sick, I should think, then about when it was organized. And I mean, you're saying that in fact improvements had been made. Or sad?
No.
I mean, with what spirit did you go? Because weren't you the head of the initial bargaining committee for the structure agreement? Would you do
one
have
of
to
the
meet
co-leaders
once,
of yeah.
once a week or
yeah.
And
no, it wasn't that made me unhappy about the structure agreement. It was the perennial insistence in the drafting of that structure agreement that what we want is control of the classroom and the content. that came into the discussions repeatedly in the structure agreement. And it was a thing that we rejected at each turn, and it came back the next day. And this, I didn't think then was proper. I didn't think it was an appropriate item for bargaining, and I don't think it is today. What's more, whether it's proper or not, I think it's a rock on which any kind of relationship will founder, because no administrative group can bargain academic content and procedures with a unit of organized labor without the faculty. If something's going to be given away, the faculty better do it. I don't think the faculty will, but I think if the administration gives away in bargaining with TAA or anybody else control of the content and structure and management of a class, then it's given away something that doesn't belong to it.
Yeah.
That's why that whole argument about whether the faculty has a role in the bargaining is so critical. Of course they do, because so many of the things that relate to the bargain are not the administration's or DERs or the Board of Regents to give. They're the property of the faculty with the responsibility for teaching a course.
So what was your general, your feeling about the atmosphere of the negotiations?
It was greatly affected by the climate of that time of student participation, desire for student participation in the design of the educational process. We're the customers, therefore we should design the courses, we should have a voice in. And my feeling about it was not good. I wasn't comfortable with it
I really meant just the physical, the kind of the behavior of the, I know others have talked about it, that of the negotiators. And I mean, that was a time when authority was being rebelled against. And did that bother you or not?
I didn't find that so much of a problem, because these were bright young people, and they were, for the most part, dedicated young people. And that didn't trouble me as much as the other thing, the persistent intrusion into the academic side of it and insistence that was right. If you're saying, was I bothered by how this message was conveyed? No, I was bothered by the message.
Yeah, I see. I mean, I know Bob DeRemus was bothered by it.
Yes.
And Camden Coberly said it wasn't the way people conducted themselves in factories when they were negotiating. As a journalist, you perhaps were more able to sit back and look at it objectively.
No. But you could sense even then that this was not the normal kind of union negotiation, and that the goal was not harmony and where can we find a place where we agree.
Was that terribly frustrating, knowing that they weren't in fact going to agree with whatever you gave?
Extremely frustrating, yes.
I should think so. I mean, that's what Ed Young says very strongly. You all knew that in fact, what they wanted to have a strike, and nothing you could do would prevent it, really.
I think we probably should call time.
Okay, would you have time to do a little bit of autobiography? I mean, where you come from, or would you rather wait and do that some other time?
No, let's quickly put it on.
All right. Well, I mean, the question is where I know where you come from, but what your parents did and what they were like and what led you into.
Oh my gracious.
An academic career? Yes. Well, it's a.
Well, what led me into a journalistic career is that living in a small town, I had a chance to be a stringer for newspapers.
Yeah, I noticed that when you were about 15.
And, well, when I was about 12.
12.
And
what was your father?
county agricultural agent.
Oh, I see. And was your mother?
Later and earlier a teacher, but at the time involved with bringing up six children.
So you expected to go to college, did you?
Mm-hmm.
That was taken for granted.
Yeah. That was, every one of the six did. And then attended University of Idaho for a year, which is about, was then by the routes that had to be traveled about 900 miles away from my home. And then went to Utah State University for the last 3 years, which was only about 30 miles from my home. So, and then when I finished there, I was working with a professor who had been himself a grad student here. And the old chain of recommendations worked. I go here and I come here on a teaching assistantship.
Had you expected to go to graduate school?
Yeah.
Right from the beginning?
Oh, from, no, I had several choices, but this was one that sounded interesting.
Why did you want to go to graduate school?
Well, why not?
This is 1940, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So your path to Wisconsin was a foregone conclusion in a way.
And then joined the faculty here, then went off for a couple of years in the armed forces, came back at the end of the war, and after a couple of years went up to Minnesota.
Why did you go to Minnesota?
Because we all agreed, the department and I, that I didn't want to get a degree at Wisconsin and then continue on the faculty here. So
that was an unusual practice.
I went on
chemistry and bacteriology.
Well, those were bigger departments and bigger programs, and I was in a very small department here and would have been involved surely with the degree with the same people that I'd later be working with as a small group of colleagues.
Yes.
So I went off to Minnesota and finished up the degree there and came back.
Your subject was politics in newspaper reporting. Is that right?
Yeah.
Or one of them.
Mm-hmm. The thing I did a thesis at Minnesota on was the political content of Wisconsin papers. But the degree interest was because I was involved with the use of the mass media to report agriculture, kind of the reporting of a public agency, a state university, and so political science, public administration, journalism, area of study, and that's what I got my degree in, governmental use of media, if there were any single description of the degree.
It's fun to get the reasons why people come to the UW. Yours is the simplest kind. Well, the simplest kind is the person who's offered a job here, but coming as a graduate student is
much more typical. As you have probably discovered, one of your interviewees, Hank Lardy, was one of a sequence of 10 distinguished biochemists, all of whom came from South Dakota State. One after another, whenever the South Dakota chair was open, the professor out there recommended another, and the professors here accepted. And the choices were good on both sides.
And they've talked about what they got there at the University of South Dakota, which is interesting.
South Dakota State.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's essentially what I had in mind. Is there more that you would want to add to it?
Well, might mention that I've been away from here on four different occasions. One, a couple of years after the PhD, I spent 3 or 4 months in Germany with a West German government and USAID training course for young agricultural journalists from the different universities there. Then, 8 or 10 years later, a semester in Africa with the Rockefeller Foundation as planning officer for the University of East Africa, which was the umbrella body that was in charge of higher education for all of the three East African countries, Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania.
Was that something you applied for or were
No.
offered? Or?
No, they were having trouble staffing it, and the Rockefeller Foundation was looking for people who had had some administrative experience here, and they wanted to have a Wisconsin connection. They wanted Wisconsin to take some responsibility for this, and I agreed I'd go. And it involved dealing with the three countries on funding and with the three universities on their curriculum and their staffing appointments and so on. In a way, a little like a university system job. Then my family and I spent a semester in Germany in the early 1960s as a visiting professor at the University of Bonn and on a Fulbright. And then in 1970, when I decided that I was sort of burned out in administration.
Why did you leave the administration?
Oh, I just got worn down a little bit.
You certainly picked the right time to leave.
No,
was there anything in that?
Not really. I think it cleared up after that.
Well, you left February 1970.
Yeah.
With the TA strike in Cambodia.
Yeah. There were 3 or 4 bad months there, but I had a feeling I was doing the same thing day after day and not accomplishing much out of it. And one of the Rockefeller Foundations, the Agricultural Development Council, had a kind of a challenging idea. They wanted to encourage better relationships among the U.S.-trained people who were back in Southeast Asia. Because, as they put it, the relationships were closer between Thailand and Oregon State than they were between Thailand and Malaysia. Closer between Malaysia and Cambridge than they were between Malaysia and Indonesia. Closer between Indonesia and Wisconsin than between Indonesia and Thailand. So they said they and the Canadian International Development Research Center said, here is a fund that you can use to try to improve this situation and write your own program on it. So I did just that and organized some conferences and seminars that brought people together and some cooperative research projects. Oh yeah, it's now quite standard. It was part of a wave at its time that a lot of others joined into, I think a little later. This was about the first, but now it's quite a common thing, the development of inter-country networks. Networking is now the word. But this was one of the earliest of these efforts, and it worked beautifully, because if you are talking about rice marketing, why, here are 10 countries that are as interested in what one another can contribute in that as they could be. And they know that Oregon State or Wisconsin or Minnesota can't contribute anything on it. So it was a very pleasant experience because it was an unfilled need that everyone jumped at. They got involved in some cooperative or shared publications, including some books of readings that were then used in universities in a number of countries. So after 4 years of that, which started out to be 2 years but dragged on to 4, then I came back.
Did you have any hesitations about accepting the appointment under Irving Shane?
Not.
You were pleased at it. It wasn't that you were coming into.
What kind of hesitations?
Well, I mean, you when Bill Sewell asked you to be vice chancellor, you had some conditions that you set, and well, that was a much more traumatic time.
What ones does he say I set?
He said you wouldn't, you didn't want to have anything to do with students.
Oh, with student affairs.
Student affairs, yes.
Student counseling and that kind of thing. It wasn't that I didn't want to have anything to do with students, but I didn't want to be in the counseling area or the operation of the Memorial Union or the...
Shouldn't have had to do that anyway.
No. No, I guess the only deal I drove with Chancellor Shane was that I not have anything to do with intercollegiate athletics.
Well,
but